Well, a journey we started about 6 weeks ago was the journey to take us through the last hours of the life of Jesus. And that journey started on this week as Christians around the world celebrate what we call Holy Week, Passion Week. You know, the week starts with the palm branches and the celebration, the way our service started this morning, but it moves through Jesus' last week of teaching, and then it leads to that last meal, which begins the last hours of the life of Jesus Christ. You know, he eats that last meal with his disciples, the Last Supper, and he prays in Gethsemane, and he's arrested and taken before trial. And the next morning, he's taken before trial again before Pilate. And it begins the final hours of the life of Jesus until we come to this last moment of all. And I'm calling our message today, A Day to Die. We begin reading in Mark chapter 15, verses 25 through 39. And we're going to read among the most important words that have ever been written and the most important words that can ever be read. The text tells us again about the time, the hour. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two rebels with him. You know, we say crucified between two thieves, you know? One on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by, they hurled insults at him, they shaking their heads saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." But not just the people who passed by, verse 31 tells us. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." And those crucified with him heaped insults on him. Mark's not done telling us about hours, though. Verse 33, at noon. Now you think about it, noon, when the sun is blazing in all of its brilliance, it says at noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, so people heard him. He spoke these words, these are the words to Jesus in Aramaic, the language that he would have spoken, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." There are words that translate into English, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those who were standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." The word Eli in Elijah sounds almost exactly the same. Someone ran and filled a sponge with some wine vinegar and they put it on a staff and they offered it to Jesus to drink. And they said, "Now, leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down." And with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. Verse 38 tells us that the curtain of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely, this man was the Son of God." This is the last hour of the life of Jesus. And scene by scene, Mark paints for us a picture that we must not miss this morning. This first scene, we would just simply call it the crucifixion. Isn't it interesting that the gospel doesn't give us much detail here? Today, this would be the thing we'd want to know the most about. But the people who had seen crucifixions didn't want to talk about them. We're told in verse 25 that the time Jesus was crucified was at 9 a.m. I mean, all the events of the previous night, he hadn't even slept. He had been in trials all night long and in the morning, and he had gone through all that he went through. And then they take him and they crucify him. He probably hadn't eaten. He hadn't drank anything. That's why they keep offering him stuff to drink. And then over him, they give the written note. We call it in Latin the titulus, the title. And one of the Gospels tells us that the written charge over Jesus' head was actually inscribed in three languages. And what was happening to Jesus is he was being punished as a Roman criminal. And when they punished criminals, they would write the charge over them so everyone would know, this is the crime that this guy committed. And the crime that Jesus committed was that he claimed to be the King of the Jews. In Hebrew, in Latin, and in Greek, it was written something that looked something like this if it was fully written out. A lot of times you'll see in the paintings, the medieval painters will just write the words I-N-R-I. That's the Greek letters, Iesus, Nazareth, Rex, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And the words are sort of written out in that sense. Here they're fully written out in Hebrew, in Latin, and then in the capital uncial letters of the Greek alphabet. Now, as this charge is being leveled against Jesus and written over him, there's a whole nother story going on in the Bible. That while the Romans are doing this and the Jews are doing this, there's another story that had been written about hundreds and hundreds of years before in the book of Isaiah and in the Psalms. And in this moment, Scripture was being fulfilled. Scripture that had predicted the insults and the death of Jesus. One of those very, very famous scriptures of the Old Testament that describe and literally are quoted here in Mark's gospel on the lips of the people who are mocking Jesus is Psalm 22, verse 6 through 7, which says, "But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people." And then look at these words, "All who see me mock me." Think about this. These were words written, 900 years earlier. "All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads." And who would have known that psalm written at that time so many years before would perfectly describe the events that would happen to Jesus as he's being crucified in scene one. But the next scene, scene two, is the scene of the darkness. And this scene really stands out in the gospel because it's noon. And you don't expect the sun to not be shining at noon. Maybe if it was clouds or something like this. And so the question that everyone always asks in every History Channel special on the cross is always going to talk about this. Did this really happen? Because this is where the skeptic comes in full force and goes, "There's no way this could have happened," right? And so there's all these naturalistic explanations. One of the things that sometimes people say is, well, the sun can't just be darkened in the middle of the day. I mean, what really happened here? One of the most common naturalistic theories is that it was a dust storm, a so-called Compson dust storm that blows in, which, I kind of think that people would realize the difference between a dust storm and something that was supernatural. But the most common explanation for this throughout history has been a solar eclipse. You kind of look and see what a solar eclipse looks like. Not much. If you've ever seen one, you can't really see much. Now, why couldn't it have been a solar eclipse? How do we know it wasn't a solar eclipse? Well, I know 100% sure this was not a solar eclipse. You say, how do you know that? Because Jesus was crucified during the festival called Passover. And according to 1,500 years of Jewish tradition, Passover always happened during a full moon. And solar eclipses only happen during a new moon. So it's actually impossible. And in fact, solar eclipses only last at most 7 minutes and 31.1 seconds, to be sort of exact. 7 minutes and 31 seconds does not equate to 3 hours in the middle of the noonday. What happens here is actually something supernatural, not just because the Bible says so, but because history says so. There are at least 2 other Roman historical witnesses who are not Christians who speak about this event. A man named Thallus, a non-Christian Roman historian in the first century, writes about it. Another man named Phlegnon of Tralles in the second century also mentions the darkness. And a Christian writer named Tertullian says that this event was written in the annals of Roman history. People all over Rome wondered, what in the world is going on? The sun is not shining in the middle of the day. This was a known supernatural, unexplained event. But from the gospel writer's perspective, and from the perspective of Jesus, what was happening on the outside, the outward sign in the sky, was itself only a small shadow of what was happening on the inside of Jesus. This is an outward sign of the inner Jesus. As the sun, the most brilliant object in the sky, would grow dark, so would the Son of God grow dark. Within him, he would cry out the words of the psalmist, Psalm 22, verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? The psalm that expresses the feeling of the silence of God, of God's distance. And when they heard him saying this, Eli, they went and got a sponge and they said, hey, maybe he's calling Elijah, because there were stories. People told stories. You know, we have our stories. They had their stories. There was a story they told, and it's written in the book called the Talmud, the Jewish holy book, that sometimes that if they cried out to Elijah, God would rescue them. And there was even a story about a guy named Eleazar who had been rescued from the Romans and in that period of time. And so this is something that people had heard about or people had talked about. But the moment here, this darkening of the sky, this outward sign of an inner Jesus, would come to its full moment in verse 37. The initial cry, which everyone heard, my God, why have you forsaken me, is then followed by another cry in verse 37. It says that there was a loud cry and he breathed his last. Someone called this the cry heard around the world. The cry heard around the world. The prophet Jeremiah has a statement like this in the Old Testament. In Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 46, he says, the earth will shake with the shout. Babylon has been taken. And it's the cry of despair that will be heard around the world. When the Jews of the Old Testament were defeated, it was a cry that was heard around the world, a cry of despair. As Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is dying on the cross, there is a cry heard around the world. And that's the scene of darkness. But there's one more scene here. In Mark's gospel, the scene stands out. It's climactic in this gospel. It's hugely important and it must not be overlooked. And it is scene number 3, the scene of the centurion. It's one of my favorite scenes in the gospel because it gives us a perspective, not just from the Jewish perspective, but from the Roman perspective. The scene is started for us in verse 38 when we're told what happened when Jesus died. First of all, it says that the temple veil was torn from the top to the bottom. This is a very interesting description in the gospel. There's a whole lot of significance to it, so I just want to take a second and try to help you understand maybe just a little bit of the significance of this moment. The temple, inside of the temple were several curtains, and one temple curtain or the temple veil separated everyone from the Holy of Holies. And you can see this image sort of imagining what it was like, this massive curtain being torn, not from the top to the bottom, not because somebody went over there with a Roman sword and cut it open, but as though the hand of God was ripping open. Now, what does this moment mean? The author of Hebrews tries to help us explain this. The New Testament writer who wrote this book says in Hebrews 10:20 that by a new and a living way opened for us through the curtain that is his body. And he's saying, look, one of the things God did was he opened himself up to us. He broke the veil that separated us. He was saying, look, now there's a way for us to be again in right relationship, and it happens through his body. As he's dying, he's opening a way. Earlier in the book of Hebrews chapter 9, the author tries to help us understand what the temple looked like and what was going on in the temple and the tabernacle before it. And he gives this description. Just let's read it, Hebrews 9, 1 through 5. Now he says in the first covenant, the old covenant, it had regulations for worship and there was an earthly sanctuary. And a tabernacle or a temple was set up. And in the first room, there was a lampstand and a table with some consecrated bread, and it was just called the holy place. But behind the second curtain, there was a room, it's called the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place. Inside of it, he just says that there was a golden altar of incense and a gold-covered ark of the covenant. Think Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? This ark contained the gold jar of manna. Aaron's staff had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant that Moses had brought down from the mountain. And above the ark were these angelic beings called the cherubim of the glory, and they overshadowed the atonement cover. In other words, this was the Holy of Holies. No one was allowed into this place because God's presence was symbolically represented by it. So that everyone knew, one thing's for sure, God is really holy, and you can never go into God's presence. And this is the moment when God himself tears open the veil and says, no, I am making a way. Now, I want to show you something. If you've never seen this before in Mark's gospel, it is absolutely unbelievable. The gospel of Mark sort of ends with this scene, but it also began with this scene. And it begins very quickly in Mark chapter 1, verses 9 through 11. We see Jesus begin his ministry. And it says this, at the time Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and he was baptized by John in the Jordan, just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being, what are those words? Torn open. It's the exact same word that's used here, that heaven was being ripped open. And the Spirit of God descending on him like a dove, and a voice from heaven said, you're my son whom I love, with you I'm well pleased. God was opening up heaven. He was pouring out his presence. He was revealing himself to us. He was saying, I'm breaking through, and I'm creating a new way for you to have a relationship with me. And it's happening through what's happening right here in this moment on the cross. And I mean, this is an incredible moment. And it's so incredible that the gospel writer tells us that a man standing there, not a believer, but the Roman centurion guard, declared Jesus was the Son of God. This is an amazing moment. The centurion is a very important person in the Roman military system. We can show you an image of sort of what a Roman centurion looked like. I kind of look at that picture and I think, that's a little over the top. But that was the point, wasn't it? It's intimidating. A centurion was the literal backbone of the Roman military. It was the highest ranked non-commissioned officer in the Roman military. They oversaw between 80 and 100, the word century comes from that, soldiers. They were the absolute best of the best. They were the Navy SEALs of the Roman military. This man had done things that all of us couldn't even imagine doing. But as he was standing there watching a Jew die on the cross, this Roman looks and he says, surely this man is the Son of God. Now, Son of God can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You know, Israel sometimes called its king the Son of God because David had a statement like that. But on the lips of a Roman, the word Son of God had one of two meanings. It could refer to the emperor who declared himself to be the Son of God and wanted people to worship him. Or it could be exactly what this gospel was written from the very beginning to reveal to us, that this man really is the Son of God. In fact, some of Jesus' disciples got a sense of this. It happened in Mark 9 when they went up on a mountain, Peter, James, and John, and all of a sudden there was this incredible glory that filled the top of the mountain. We call it the Transfiguration. In Mark 9, 7, it says this. And this is the second time they hear the voice of heaven say this. A cloud appeared and it covered them, and a voice came from the cloud talking about Jesus. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. This is my son. This is what this gospel was written to reveal to us. That this man dying on the cross is the Son of God. In fact, if you go back to the very first words of the Gospel of Mark, these are the very first words. The beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. That's the beginning. This moment is the last moment of the life of Jesus. And it takes all these chapters and all these hours and all these moments for people to finally realize. Even a Roman standing there looking at him. Surely, this man is the Son of God.